Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, the Kentucky Department of Education released graduation and dropout numbers last week, but some say those numbers don't tell the whole story. First, earlier this month, President Obama called on Congress to tackle the issue of health care reform this year. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi predicted there could be a bill under consideration in her chamber by the end of July. Gabe Bullard has been speaking to some local officials about why health care is so expensive and what kind of legislation might emerge from Capitol Hill.
I get pain in here and down into almost to my knee.
When Mary downsized and broke her hip, she went to the doctor for a stress test to see if she could undergo joint replacement surgery.
My whole body was in the machine they were using, but I think the pictures were just of the midsection of my body.
Later on, her daughter Karen got the bill.
It's listed as cardiopulmonary, and that's like $1,537.82. Medical imaging, $71,69.97. And the drugs and pharmacy, $237. So it comes out to $8,944.79.
Look at it in terms of a value proposition. I think the important thing is to say, what do you have access to? What services are you able to get? How fast can you get those services?
Dr. Steve Hester is the chief medical officer of Norton Healthcare. He says medical costs not only include procedures and treatments, but various hospital services needed to offer those treatments. For example, the bills pay for doctors of all specialties, from anesthesia to heart catheterization, to be on call around the clock.
Some of those costs are put into the overall cost of healthcare because those are all services as a community that we want available. We may not realize that we want them until we need them.
With that in mind, Hester says healthcare costs, on average, break down like this. For each dollar, 21 cents goes to care. 10 cents to drugs, 7 cents to administrative costs, 8 cents to home care, 21 cents to clinical services, and 23 cents to maintain the building and other costs. And some of the money covers people who can't pay their bills. Hester says Norton spends about $40 million each year on charity care. It's a cost that might not exist if the United States, like many other countries, provided health care for all citizens. But Hester says so-called universal health care is not necessarily high-quality health care.
Some of those systems offer delayed times that you can get the services.
Have you tried to get an appointment with an allergist or a dermatologist recently? I mean, there are long waits for care in the United States in certain areas, too.
Third District Congressman John Yarmuth is a proponent of government-provided health care. But he says the single-payer system of nations like England and Canada isn't coming to America anytime soon. Under Yarmuth's plan, the millions of Americans without insurance could sign up for a government plan. People with private coverage could keep their plans or enroll in the government system. Ideally, he says, that would create competition among private insurers, competition that in other industries has led to lower prices, better service, and innovations.
That will force the private sector to compete effectively on some way or another, on either extra services or on extra quality.
But some health insurance providers aren't happy with the prospect of government involvement. Tony Seltz with Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield says the best way to help the uninsured is to have the government help them pay for coverage and not for health care.
We believe that some sort of subsidy, government subsidy, would be necessary for those who otherwise are not going to be able to afford a private health care insurance.
Yarmuth and Seltz do agree on one thing, the need for better preventive care and education, which would help drive down health care costs. As for the Dan Sisson's $9,000 medical bill, the government and private insurance will cover it. Kathy Dan Sisson says that's the only way her mother's bill will get paid.
If she did not have Medicare and the insurance, the secondary insurance, would we have paid for it ourselves? I don't think so.
For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
Gabe's story is on our website in addition to a blog titled 6 Degrees of Healthcare. That's at WFPL.org. Statistics released this week by Kentucky officials indicate graduation rates and dropout rates are up in the Commonwealth. However, as Kentucky Public Radio Charles Compton tells us, there's good reason to believe those numbers might be inaccurate.
An annual report from the Kentucky Department of Education seemingly contains good news. State statistics indicate the number of graduates increased by 1%. Lisa Gross, who speaks for the department, says that signals an encouraging trend.
I think overall you can attribute it to schools doing a better job of meeting kids' needs, because that's what it takes to graduate kids. You've got to figure out what kids need, and they all need different things.
The number of graduates who go on to college is also up, and the number of students who fail to move on to the next grade decreased significantly. However, school attendance dropped slightly, plus the number of high school dropouts remains flat. Of bigger concern was the number of minority students who left school. Gross says dropout rates for blacks and Hispanics is double the rate for white students.
Kentucky's not alone. This is a national problem. It tends to affect African Americans more than any other group simply because they are our largest minority group, but Hispanics are gaining on them as far as size, and you're seeing the same kinds of trends with Hispanics that you are with African Americans, where dropout rates are higher than their white peers. And it's hard to know why.
The federal No Child Left Behind Act holds individual schools accountable if they don't graduate enough students. But are these numbers accurate? Susan Weston says no.
You have discovered a swamp.
I have.
Yes,
actually, you did. I just...
I have been in the swamp. Now you started to smell the things that are caught in the swamp.
Weston, who's a consultant with the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, a statewide watchdog group, says the data is flawed. She says Kentucky has no method for tracking individual students.
They're quite inexact. And the problem is, what does the school do when a kid doesn't show back up in the fall? And we're not getting good enough numbers to figure out what happened to them. Most kids, if we had a better data system, most of them are in another Kentucky high school, and we could find them, and we could probably make a good list of kids where we don't know where they are and go looking for them.
Weston says the state cannot even track students as they move from the eighth grade into high school, so she doesn't really trust the official graduation numbers. Still, she suspects the Commonwealth has more high school graduates than in the past. Weston notes schools are handing out more diplomas in proportion to their overall enrollment. And don't ask her about dropout rates. She doesn't like talking about them because they're probably higher than the stats indicate, overlooking at least 2,000 students.
Anybody who looks at what's the dropout rate for Madison County Central or Danville High, unless they looked at how the number was calculated, would get an impression that things were pretty good when they really do involve a lot of kids leaving school.
Without solid figures, Weston says Kentucky cannot measure the quality of education.
At the moment, I think we have multiple thousands where we don't know what happened to them.
Kentucky is now implementing a system for tracking students. It's overdue, but Weston says every child will have a tracking number. So unless a student leaves the Commonwealth, education officials will know what happened to that child. However, Weston says it'll be 4 more years before the new system generates meaningful measurements. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Charles Compton.
Last week in Louisville, the Kentucky chapter of a group called Seniors for Kids held an awards ceremony to mark its first year. It's an organization of people over the age of 50 who advocate and perform other work in support of early childhood education initiatives. Among those honored at last Thursday's event was former state lawmaker and civil rights leader Georgia Powers and the Kentucky State Foster Grandparents Program. Seniors for Kids was created by a national group called Generations United. I spoke with Donna Butts, the executive director of Generations United, and Pat Morrell, who volunteers for the Seniors for Kids program in Louisville. Donna begins by describing the group's work.
Generations United Seniors for Kids is a civic engagement initiative that mobilizes adults over the age of 50 on behalf of children, and in particular on behalf of quality pre-K programs.
So the gist of it, or the focus of it, is pre-K education.
Correct, and showing the support that older adults have for investing in children early in life so that they're more successful later in life.
How did this organization get started?
Well, Generations United started over 20 years ago, and we were started to help represent most of the children, youth, and aging groups in the country to promote programs and public policies that build bridges between generations. So a few years ago, we started the Seniors for Kids initiative as a way for older adults to become engaged as advocates on behalf of children. So it's one of the initiatives that we work with here at Generations United.
And this is a nationwide effort?
Yes, it is. Generations United is a national membership organization, and Seniors for Kids has expanded now into 4 states.
I see. Well, Pat Morrell is here with us, and Pat, thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about what you do as a volunteer.
Well, Our Kentucky Seniors for Kids has been organized for about a year, and we have met to get the facts that we need about Kentucky, and then we have met with our legislators to learn our way around the legislature. We thought it was important to highlight the fact that seniors do care about what happens to children. I go back as far as when Generations United was started, and we were all fighting over the meager funds coming down for human resources. And so we said, look, we can't have children and seniors fighting against each other. And thus, I think Generations United was born.
You're right, Pat.
I'm really senior, you see. We wanted to celebrate, though, the many ways in which seniors do interact with children and do support children. And we are looking down the road to the next legislative session, where we will do all we can to educate our legislators about the significance and importance of early childhood.
So is this the single focus of the organization, or are there other elements that go with it that you are pushing for?
No, basically it's just the advocating for pre-K and early childhood, making it available to all children.
What kind of a response have you gotten from lawmakers?
Well, personally, I've been involved for many years with many different legislators, and it's up and down. However, I think that that we're making headway. You know, I do think that the climate has changed, and they are beginning to understand that that prevention is better than remedy, whether you're talking education or health, whatever.
And I would agree with Pat, because I think that we're really starting to see the tide sort of shift, and that policymakers are realizing that even in these tight economic times, investments early in life pay dividends later in life, that if we don't invest early, we're going to have to invest even more later on when we're dealing with young people who weren't able to learn or didn't have some of the opportunities to be engaged citizens in their communities and to be productive citizens.
And those of us who've lived a long time have seen firsthand what lifelong effects there are of either good or bad early childhood education.
What do we mean by early childhood education, for those who may not know? Are we talking Head Start, that sort of thing?
Well, we start actually with the child care, which is infancy on up. Specifically, push right now is to make preschool available, and preschool is 3- and 4-year-olds. Mm-hmm. So, it's basically those pre-kindergarten years.
Donna, what's the progress report elsewhere in the country?
Well, we've been making some very good progress, and I think a part of it is because what we see with older adults becoming engaged is sort of an unlikely ally. It's a group that is growing in size. For example, in Kentucky, in 10 years, about 36% of the population will be over the age of 50. So it's a growing resource. They're becoming engaged in this issue, and their voices are really being heard. But we're also seeing high-profile individuals become engaged in Seniors for Kids and engaged on behalf of children. For example, in Kentucky, the First Lady Jane Beshear is joined by all the former First Ladies as honorary co-chairs of Seniors for Kids. In Florida, we had all of the former governors, and in New York, we have former Mayor David Dinkins. So we have high-profile people who are saying we're older adults and we care about children.
All right. Donna Butts, Pat Morrell with Generations United and the Seniors for Kids program. Thanks for joining us today. There's more information on early childhood education and Generations United at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, we'll hear from the outgoing director of the Kentucky Council of Churches. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL.
Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Stephanie Sanders has a report on church giving and how it has changed in the recession. First, the woman who heads the Kentucky Council of Churches will retire next month. The Reverend Nancy Jo Kemper began her tenure in the summer of 1991. After spending much of her early career in the pulpit, Kemper admits she didn't know what to expect in her new position. In recent years, the Reverend has spent a lot of time in Frankfurt, where she became a leading lobbyist. In a conversation with Kentucky Public Radio's Stu Johnson, Kemper says she never got the impression at the state capitol that it's wrong to mix politics and religion.
I think that given the kind of Bible Belt state that we are, a lot of them believe that religious values do apply to everyday life and apply to all of life, economics as well as politics, our social fabric and other things. So no, I was more likely to get a feeling from legislators and media and a lot of others that the role of being sort of a conscience for the state was a productive and useful one, and at least I hope it was.
Do you recall the first time that you came to Frankfurt and what that was about?
Wow. It might have been about something like domestic violence or legislation with regard to children's breakfasts at schools. It took me a while to kind of get my feet under me. It took me about a year and a half to begin to understand where I might fit in Frankfurt, I think, and might begin to have something to say. It wasn't long after I had arrived, late 1992, that the phone rang one day, and my secretary, in great surprise, said the governor was on the phone and wanted to speak to me. I was surprised, too. It was Governor Jones, and he was trying to get our position on health care reform, and so we immediately began to dig in on health care reform, and we have worked on health care reform issues ever since.
What kind of gains do you think have been made, and what remains to be done? I guess, I mean, that's a pretty
Well, Kentucky was really a pioneer and a leader in that 1992 to 1994 period of time when we tried to set up the health care advisory boards, ways of to eliminate cherry picking and a variety of other kinds of things. And then, of course, the insurance companies undid all that very rapidly and blamed the governor for ruining the insurance market in Kentucky, quote-unquote. But in the meantime, I suspect that the kinds of things that Governor Jones tried to advance will be the end national product that we come out with, something like that, through the Obama administration.
You could envision the national approach to be something similar to what passed in, like, 94, I guess, right?
Yes, sure could.
You may know, I can't even recall when the first mention of expanding gambling came. Do you?
Well, there was a group that Jerry Carroll, who is one of the owners of Turfway Racetrack, started called Kentucky to the Front. And Pat Malloy was, I think, the lobbyist for it. But groups would invite me to debate with Pat. And it was often the case that I could get our arguments down to the 10 to 15 minute level, whereas he had a half an hour or an hour's worth of materials, and usually I could out argue him in the 15 minutes, knowing as a preacher how long 15 minutes is. And he always never finished his argument, so people didn't quite get the point.
The Reverend Nancy Jo Kemper says she hopes to devote much of her retirement to moving in a different direction, saying she's tired of being pegged as somebody who's always against something. Reverend Marion McClure Taylor of Louisville will succeed Kemper next month. Budgets are tight from households to high rises. During these tough economic times, more people are turning to churches and religious organizations for help. Stephanie Sanders reports on how two of them are responding to the needs of the community while trying to keep their own books balanced.
With your test results, it looks like you definitely have a bladder infection, so we need to get you some antibiotics. Do you have any allergies to medicine?
Jill Baldwin is the administrator of Mercy Medical Clinic in Shelbyville. She's also a nurse practitioner and the only employee of this free clinic. You might call it one of the front lines of battle in the recession. The clinic has doubled its number of patients over the last year, from 1,300 to 2,600, and is on track to add another 1,000 by the end of the year.
We have patients calling every single day. I've lost my job. I've been laid off. I have kids. We have current needs. And so our phone is constantly ringing off the hook, and our needs are growing significantly.
Mercy Medical's parent organization is Operation Care. Executive Director Judy Roberts says, as to be expected in a recession, some of its private funding has decreased.
Our personal contributions are down about 45%. Our business contributions are down 50%. Our church contributions are up, believe it or not.
Those church contributions are up about 60%. Operation Care has several church partnerships, including one with Southeast Christian Church, the largest congregation in Louisville, where, for disclosure's sake, I'm a member.
When the economy tanks, I think it's a perfect time for churches to step up to the plate.
Southeast Senior Minister Dave Stone.
It could be in a variety of different ways, but it is not the time for churches just to sit back and say, well, you know what, everybody's having a rough time.
Local outreach was on the minds of Stone and the church's elders when they approved an aggressive budget late last year, increasing its $31 million budget by 4.5% in the throes of the economic downturn.
We felt like there are things that we wanted to do in this community, and we sensed and felt that God would bless, you know, that step of faith.
And so far, the church is on track to meet its budget. The church's commitment to local community organizations like Mercy Medical Clinic increases as parishioners increase their giving. Stone says Southeast has committed 16.5% of its budget to local, national, and international missions. About $1.6 million went to local projects like the free clinic. Champaign, Illinois-based research group Empty Tomb has been researching church giving in recessions over the last several decades. Its studies show that nationwide, member donations to churches are just as likely to go up as they are to go down in a recession. And Operation Care's Judy Roberts says while money is great, volunteers are gold.
If all of our volunteers suddenly were removed, the entire programs, all three programs, would have to close down. There would be no way we could operate without them.
Southeast Christian Church has seen a huge spike in volunteers working in the community. Over the last 18 months, the number has climbed from 250 to 500. Time is something even small congregations with much smaller budgets can contribute. At St. William Catholic Church in West Louisville, Formation Minister Ann Walter says the church's $3,000 to $4,000 per month allotment for those who are struggling is falling short these days.
We have gotten to the point where we are out of money most of every month.
Walter says people are often standing in line to receive money for food, utilities, rent, and medicine. She says donations are steady, but more people are giving their time.
It's jumped considerably lately. And so that on Wednesdays, it used to be a couple of us handled what would happen in trying to respond to phone calls and distribute the funds. And now there are five or six people here.
So even when churches' budgets are tight, parishioners are stepping up, giving their money and their time. For WFPL, I'm Stephanie Sanders.
That story is on our website, in addition to a blog post where you can share how you or your house of worship are stepping up for the community. It's at WFPL.org. There is certainly more than one road to recovery in the fight against drug addiction. Professionals who have studied substance abuse recovery for years will tell you as much. What works for one person may not be the answer for everyone. One strategy is based on religion. We go back to Kentucky Public Radio's Stu Johnson for a report on how such faith-based treatment programs work.
35-year-old Roger Crow, who's a native of Winchester, began using at age 12. At first, it was marijuana. Crow then escalated to alcohol, nerve pills, and eventually prescription pain pills. After a minor car crash, Crow took his first Percocet painkiller. In time, he was taking 15 to 20 pills a day.
It starts out all fun and games, and then when you get hooked on them, it's no fun and games no more because your body gets sick and you have to have them. You know, you're not using them to get high no more. You're using them to keep your body from being sick and hurting to where you can function just normal every day.
Kroll remembers what he calls his drug couch at his mother's house.
My mom used to always tell me, son, you're going to get hooked on them. Please be careful, don't get hooked on those. I'd always say, I'm not going to do it. And then that was when I first started out. I'm not going to get hooked on them, Mom. But at the end of the long road I took on drugs, I was telling my mom, I'm going to do drugs to the day I die. Because I was so hooked, that's my mindset, was I can't get off from them. There's no way. But there is a way to get off from them.
Soon, Crow faced 10 years in prison for doctor shopping. And that got him into treatment. First, a 30-day program at Corbin, and then at Lighthouse Ministries in downtown Lexington.
Father God, we just come before you, Lord, and thank you for...
Well, we believe that God's the answer. And, well, the Bible says that if any man be in Christ, he's a new creation. Old things are passed away, and all things become new.
Tay Henderson directs Lighthouse Ministries. Henderson leads a group of 10 or so men, all with criminal records. Her husband, Dan, founded Lighthouse Ministries in 1993. He knew firsthand the ravages of drug use.
He was converted in Detroit jail, and I met him later after he had been a Christian like 3 years. I met him in Michigan, and we ended up getting married later. But, I mean, people can change. So that's the thing. People can change, and he changed, and he spent his whole life giving back.
Henderson says Dan passed away about 2 years ago from complications related to past drug use. Like her husband, Tay Henderson also abused drugs years ago. The counselors who work in the Lighthouse Drug Recovery Program are not necessarily certified by an outside agency. Instead, they rely on their past drug abuse experience as a tool when they counsel other men. In the program, Henderson says the men take God not as a crutch, but God as an answer.
Did you all read your homework from last week? Did you read it within the last couple of days or anything?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tom McClelland is in the business of assessing drug recovery programs. McClelland's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also President Obama's appointee as deputy director at the Office of National Drug Control Policy.
We don't honestly know why certain people respond to faith-based, certain people respond to medications, certain people respond to other kinds of behavioral treatment. Some respond to the love of a good woman.
McClelland's not aware of any specific study that compares faith-based recovery programs with secular programs. He believes it's good to have as many options as possible when breaking dependence on drugs.
They're not incompatible. You can have a spiritual approach with a medicinal approach, with a behavioral approach, and often they're some of the things that work the best.
Carl Luckfeld directs the University of Kentucky Department of Behavioral Science. Luckfeld says individuals who find success often talk about spirituality. He adds, spirituality may or may not focus specifically on the divine.
Just talk to anybody who's in recovery, a good recovery, and they'll say, yes, I believe in something. Is it a deity? No. Does 12 steps talk about, or self-help talk about God? Talks about God as we know him, and that's a very different thing than God as God.
Change came, Roger Crowe says, when he allowed God into his life. For 2 years now, Crowe has been clean, and he also works as a counselor at Lighthouse Ministries. A police roadblock is no longer a time of anxiety.
I was actually anxious to go through the roadblock because I had good driver's license, I had good insurance, had no drugs on me, I was clean. You know, and the cop just walked up and looked at my license, handed them back. He didn't run no numbers. He didn't get me out of the vehicle or anything. And I said, wow, that was awesome, because 2 or 3 years ago, I would have been trying to figure out a way to run.
Drug use did have an indelible impact on Crow and his family. Crow's health suffered, and his sister died from an overdose. Crow remains eager to repair some of the damage he's done.
Once I get to see my daughter now, she's going to have her dad. You know, that's something she didn't have before. My daughter didn't want for anything, you know, but she wanted for one thing, and that was her father. She wanted my time and my love, and that's something that, you know, it was kind of hard for me to give her in the addiction I was in. But now when we get back together this time, it's going to be a good reunion, and she's going to have her dad in her life.
For any recovery program to work, Crow says the substance abuser must be ready to make a change. Veteran drug and alcohol researchers like Tom McClellan and Carl Lukefeld agree having something to hold on to is important as one tries to break a dependency on drugs. Reporting for Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Stu Johnson.
When we come back, Kristen Espeland looks at changes in the landscaping industry related to climate change. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer talks with the directors of an upcoming local production of As You Like It. First, climate change won't simply affect Arctic ice shelves and polar bears. It will reach into our very own backyards. As Kristen Espeland reports, some of the people most familiar with those backyards are planning ahead for a warming world.
John Pasiga heads the landscape architecture firm Verdant Design. We're in his backyard surveying some beds he's preparing for some native Kentucky plants. While many of his peers in the landscaping business are still putting in some of the more traditional, exotic, and ornamental plants, Pasiga is urging clients to consider designs that may hold up better as climate patterns fluctuate.
In my plant selection, then, what I'm looking at is plants that can basically be more survivable for our area.
Pasiga says plants aren't simply going to have to adapt to higher temperatures and longer summers.
What we're seeing is not just a warming or a cooling trend, but because of where we are in the United States, I think we're going to have a little bit of both. I think that we're going to have a lot more cold and a lot more heat and drought, as well as potentially more storms.
Most scientists aren't too keen on predicting how climate change will affect a region as small as, say, Kentucky or the Ohio River Valley region. But landscapers and gardeners can tell you that changing conditions are affecting what they plant here. Many use the USDA's Plant Hardiness Zone map. It was last updated in 1990, although a revision is underway. More recently, though, the American Horticultural Society and the National Arbor Day Foundation came out with their own versions. They used more recent climate data, and they found that some areas, including Kentucky, have shifted up a full zone. That means they're 5 degrees warmer on average than they were 10 years ago. Whit Forrester graduated from college recently and is getting his own landscaping business up and running. He named it Hotter Times to draw attention to that trend.
The things keep on escalating as they are. The droughts that we've seen for the past couple of years could end up being way more severe. So in terms of stuff that grows well here, it's really hard to say, but it's definitely going to be things that do better with less water.
Forrester says he's thinking beyond simply what kinds of plants and designs he wants to recommend to clients. He says that a changing climate is an opportunity to re-examine our relationship to the land, to ask whether or not we really need individual backyards with green grass lawns that we have to water and mow. For instance, he says he'd love to see fewer fences in neighborhoods, less broken up parcels of land. He'd love to see more of a community approach to landscaping.
What that would mean for designing a landscape is that you would have healthier soil, you'd have more productive plants, you'd probably have better water-saving schemes, and also being able to have less fragmented habitats and ecosystems is also better for wildlife as well.
Forrester says part of the reason for this healthier soil is that plants do best when they establish strong relationships with what he calls fungal communities, and those do well when they can spread out. Forrester says he hasn't yet had the chance to test this theory, but researchers at Bernheim Arboretum are putting some gardening theories to the test. It's a busy Saturday afternoon here with families browsing native plants for sale. Executive Director Mark Worms shows off a cluster of experimental plant beds.
What we're testing here at Bernheim are four different groups of plants that all come from hot, dry environments.
But the plants growing in these beds aren't for your typical backyard. They're for your roof or green roof. Worms is trying to figure out which plants will do best on rooftops in the region, especially as the climate changes.
Our hypothesis is that Kentucky has a lot of native plants that will work very well in the Midwest. And one of the reasons we're interested in that is because some of those plants from glades, for example, might be rare and endangered.
Some of those native plants include Kentucky's very own kind of prickly pear cactus. Researchers will monitor how well each plant does in a variety of soils and then recommend the best combinations for future gardeners. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
L'Epidemane has performed its own plays and a few classics since it came to the local theater scene several years ago. With a troupe of six actors, the Louisville company uses the theatrical tools of Commedia d'arte, a comical and improvisational theater with roots in 15th century Italy. It involves few props and the use of masks. This week, L'Epidemane opens its take of Shakespeare's As You Like It. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with the company's co-directors, Gregory Maupin and Abigail Bailey Maupin.
What kind of theater company is L'Epidemane?
We are primarily a physical theater company. We focus on a lot of physical comedy, not in the irritating slapstick sense, we hope, but in keeping things physically based and not necessarily just about the words being said. There are actions on stage as well.
We're also an ensemble company,
yes,
which means that there are six of us who do all the work. We don't have auditions for our shows. It is just the six of us constantly doing every show and seeing what happens as the group works together for a long time.
Like a band.
Exactly.
Kind of.
And how do you choose the works that you perform? Some of them are originals that you write and produce yourselves, and then others are existing plays.
The originals, we do them more often because they're fun for us and because we have lots of ridiculous ideas that I don't think anyone else would touch with a 10-foot pole.
Such as?
Well, we perform thus far almost entirely at the Rudyard Kipling, which is tiny and non-traditional, I think is the best way to put it. It's not an auditorium. By any means. And so we've done a lot of plays based entirely in doing cinematic effects, a noir, a superhero thing.
We had the green screen for Pam.
Yes, we had a green screen effect for one of the things that inherently will not work in the Rudyard Kipling are things that we are drawn to. Like, oh, that's not going to happen. Let's do that. And the classics we do are often based in the fact that, well, one, the same reason everyone does classics, because everyone loves them and you don't have to pay to do them. And also, there are six people in this company, and any classic that we can get our hands on that we can, without breaking its poor little spine, do with six actors, that plays into our choice as well. And the comic element, again, is there. I feel like we choose comedies frequently because you can get by with doing and saying all kinds of things when you're doing a comedy, and people just sort of go, oh, yes, what a fun, fluffy little evening at the theater, and it sort of creeps in on them later. Whereas when you do something tragic or serious, people tend to be tragic and serious about it.
And among the existing plays that you've performed are Shakespeare plays.
Yes.
And this one, As You Like It, is going to be your second. When you approach Shakespeare, how do you approach it in terms of being L'Epidemane?
We do the Shakespeare in masks. So that's, I think, the biggest differentiation for us as a company that you'll see in town from other companies doing it. So that brings our physicality and our special sense of performance to the Shakespeare immediately.
And they're masks in the sense of like Commedia masks, 1500s sort of thing. Not in that style by any means, but in that energy, that mode of performance. And so you don't get a modern realism Shakespeare by any means. You get stylized because they're very stylized plays as it is. It's kind of hard to pull them off with sort of 20th century Stanislavski stuff. Masking also obviously helps the fact that there are six of us and frequently 20 or 25 characters in any standard Shakespeare. So masks and puppets and whatnot make the math work out. It makes it more theatrical somehow.
How do the masks work, I guess, for the audience? I mean, it works for you because you're able to change characters.
Sure.
What do you think it brings to the audience maybe seeing the play in a new way? And then how does that work with As You Like It?
I think the masks actually help people focus on the language a little bit more. You don't get as involved in an actor acting with their face and feeling things because as a mask actor, what you're feeling doesn't make a big difference. It's more about the physical shape, and it's much more streamlined and simplified. And I think that helps cut away a lot of extraneous acting for the audience.
Also, I know this is true of As You Like It, it was definitely true of Midsummer, that you get 25 people, you got to get the guy to play the third spear carrier or whatever that you can get. And there is something nice about being able to say, oh, look, the Rude Mechanicals that are doing their bad acting at the end of Midsummer, we know that this guy is quite a good actor. We saw him playing someone else earlier, and he's very good. He's a very good Demetrius, for example. So then we know not just some terrible hack who happens to act this poorly, which happens occasionally with that play. it's someone who you've seen do quality work before, and you go, oh, and he's doing his bad work as well. And I think with As You Like It, it's more about you draw some parallels between characters that maybe you wouldn't draw parallels between if they weren't played by the same person, the same woman in two different masks.
And in adapting the piece, because you had to chunk it down a bit because it was long, how did you choose to approach that, and what parts did you edit out?
I think the only people we really lose in As You Like It are, you know, there's at the beginning, someone says, you know, hey, the wrestler's at the door, and then he never appears again, a servant that pops in. And that became like, oh, you know, if we cut those two lines, we don't need to make someone run around, and I don't have to spend several hours building a mask. That's the only person we've really cut out of it. And there aren't as many lords. You know, the entourage out in the woods is not quite as extravagant as it would be. It's more in the line of two or three. But you know, there are a couple of scenes that we cut or reordered slightly just for logistical purposes, but it's mostly for logistics. I will say that Sir Oliver Martex, the country preacher, who is, again, a very small part, is played by three or four of us. He's an 18-inch puppet, and it's a lot easier. Well, it's difficult sometimes to make an audience think it's plausible for several people to take on a role, and we're doing it with Sir Oliver Martex because it's very easy for each of us to inhabit a puppet and stand behind it, and the audience is looking at the puppet, and if we do a reasonably similar voice to it, they're not confused, if anything, entertained by the convention. But nothing else has been cut out except for a random song in the middle, because there are many. And it's more about pruning than it is about really excising large bits.
And I guess audiences will see for themselves when it opens this Thursday.
Thursday the 28th, yes.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
In 1884, a 17-year-old Louisville woodworker named Bud Hillerick turned a piece of white ash wood into a baseball bat. That bat and Hillerick's subsequent creations were, well, a hit. 10 years later, Hillerick registered the name Louisville Slugger with the U.S. Patent Office. The Louisville Slugger brand went on to become as iconic as many of the players who used the bats. Recently, two writers, David McGee and Philip Shirley, were granted access to the Louisville Slugger Museum's photographic archives for a new coffee table book about the company and its famous product. It's called Sweet Spot, 125 Years of Baseball and the Louisville Slugger. I spoke with Philip Shirley about the book. How and why did you get involved in this particular project?
I was really intrigued by how the things that were going on in the country that allowed baseball to evolve into a spectator sport and a professional sport, and at the same time, the impact of Louisville Slugger, how it became a company that made bats, how those two things were sort of interwoven, and how the Louisville Slugger bat impacted the growth of this new sport. And I really just wanted to see if I could understand what was happening culturally, financially in the country, and what the factors were that all of a sudden made this stick and ball game that had sort of been around for centuries in one form or another, but not in the form that we recognize it today. And I was just intrigued by what would allow all of a sudden for this new country to have a spectator sport. So we wanted to explore that and realize Louisville Slugger's 125th anniversary was coming up, and it seemed like a good time to take a look at that.
Did you approach the company about doing this?
We did. We approached the CEO and the chairman, Jack Hillerick and John Hillerick, his son, who is the CEO. And they were intrigued by the idea and said that they would open up their archives and give us the chance to talk to them and understand what had happened with the history of the company and to look at their wonderful photos. And so I approached another writer named David McGee, who's written a number of business books, and asked him if he would work with me on it, because we wanted to sort of look at this company from a business perspective, and David brought that to the table, and I wanted to look at it sort of from a cultural history. I was an American Studies graduate years ago, many years ago now, but had the background, I guess, to sort of look at what was going on in American culture and try to understand what the factors were that allowed this sport to emerge as it did and ultimately become America's greatest pastime.
Now, Louisville Slugger, I would assume, has a wealth of archival information in its
possession. They do. It was I was a kid in a candy store when I got into their archive. I'll bet. It was really amazing.
Was it difficult to decide what to include in the book and what to leave out?
We looked at 7,000 photos to pick the, I'm not sure what the final number was, maybe 120 photos that we used in the book.
You mentioned the business perspective. Of course, Louisville Slugger is an American icon, but also it's a story of a family business, isn't it?
Right. Hillerick and Bradsby started as Jeff Hillerick job turning. They were a woodworking shop. They made bedposts and chair rails. They had a sort of a signature product was a swinging butter churn. You can still see one of those in the Louisville Slugger Museum. Very interesting American icon there itself. But they started out that way, and young Bud Hillerick was about 17 when he made the first bat on that fateful day in 1884 to help out a local ball player who had broken his bat. And that began what became a true, you know, baseball dynasty, if you will, in terms of bat making and making a product central to the game.
How did the Louisville Slugger become so popular? Were there other bat makers out there as well?
There were many bat makers. A number of things happened. I think in the early days, they discovered that the way to be successful was to work backwards from the customer's needs. And they always brought the player into the factory in the early days, and they made the bats exactly to that player's specifications. One of the interesting things in the archives is that there are more than 20,000, I'll call them bat cards. They started out really being index cards or small sheets of paper where they had the specs made for the individual player. And over the years, there have been, in essence, 20,000 different kinds of bats made, because they're made to the, you know, within the league specifications in terms of length and weight. They would make the bat handle or the barrel bigger or smaller, the length shorter or longer, and get the weight exactly what the player was looking for. And that's really been their success, I think, is always listening to the player. They're all about giving the player confidence, giving the player something that makes them comfortable that they will be successful in the game. And that's been their success all the way to today, even through getting into metal bats. They got into the metal a little late in the 70s, and a lot of their market went away until they worked several years perfecting their metal bats and again, reclaimed the number one spot. But for a long time, they had dropped well out of the number one position in bats as far as metal.
Now, do most major leaguers still use Louisville Slugger wooden bats?
Yes, they are still the official bat of the major leagues, and they are the dominant bat. There are some other smaller companies that do make some bats, but Louisville Slugger is still the predominant bat in the major leagues. And, of course, they're all wood bats as required by the league. And I think we all are glad of that. We still get to hear the crack of the bat, which is sort of, for those of us who are old enough to have grown up with the wooden bats, I think that's a part of the game that we remember even from our own childhood and high school or whatever, Little League, wherever we played. So we still remember the crack of the bat. It's a little bit different sound now, and the kids, even in the majors now, grew up on metal. But the wood is still the heart of the game, we think.
One of the Slugger's most famous customers is Babe Ruth, and he figures prominently in the book.
Absolutely. Babe is, you know, arguably the greatest Slugger of all time, although I think there probably are a handful of players you could put in a hat and draw any one of them out, and you would have a winner. And, you know, is it really, you know, could it have been Ken Griffey Jr. if he hadn't had so many injuries early in his career? You know, some would argue for Hank Aaron. Some might even argue Mickey Mantle or Mark McGwire or go back a ways, Jimmy Fox. You know, there were a number of those people, sluggers, that one person or another could argue is their favorite or is better. But Babe Ruth certainly was a key figure and helped make baseball what it is. I think those, We want those heroes. We want that icon. We want that slugger that we believe that at any moment we're going to see that towering home run, and Babe certainly gave us that.
More information about the book Sweet Spot and the Louisville Slugger is available at our website, wfpl.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.